This is Free Speech Radio News. It's Wednesday, January 30th, 2008. Sitting in for Auro Bogado, I'm Tandasizwe Shimaringa in Los Angeles. In today's broadcast, Michael Mukasey says he will not discuss the interrogation tactic of waterboarding. A Democratic presidential contender calls it quits after the latest primary, and Italy enters a second week with no government in place. We'll have all that and more, but first, these news headlines.
I'm Sharon Young with today's headlines. The White House has indicated that it may put the brakes on the drawdown of U.S. troop levels in Iraq. Bush ordered five more brigades into Iraq last summer as part of the so-called surge. About 20,000 troops are supposed to be home by summer, but further reductions depend largely on the recommendations of the top U.S. commander in Iraq, General David Petraeus. If the general suggests suspending the drawdown after July, troop levels will be just slightly above what they were prior to the surge. In other news, the FBI says it's investigating 14 companies for possible corporate fraud in the subprime mortgage market. Africa Jones has more on the story.
The probe focuses on securities violations and accounting fraud, including the manipulation of financial statements, insider trading, and whether the risk of subprime loans resold to third parties were fully disclosed to investors. Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, says the subprime crisis is a scandal.
Subprime mortgages that should have been regarded as very risky, they were cutting them up and repackaging them in various ways. And if you have a very risky asset, you could cut it, you could dice it, but it's still very risky. And these people are losing billions of dollars because they didn't know what they were doing. And what I didn't really understand was how you could do this in a post-Enron era.
Subprime mortgage loans account for around 13% of mortgages, but 55% of foreclosures. And rising foreclosures have led to a credit crisis, which has shaken financial markets in recent weeks. Although the FBI did not specify which companies are under investigation, several big-name banks, such as Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, are reportedly cooperating with government probes. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Africa Jones.
The Israeli High Court of Justice today ruled in favor of reducing fuel and power supplies to the Gaza Strip. Meanwhile, Palestinian political factions are in Cairo today to forge an agreement over responsibility for the Rafah crossing terminal. Rami Amigeri has more from Gaza.
The meeting comes after hundreds of thousands of Palestinians flooded into Egypt last week to buy essential supplies. The Rafah crossing terminal, located at Gaza's border with Egypt, was sealed in June of last year after Israel imposed a closure on Gaza in response to the Hamas takeover of the coastal territory. A U.S. brokered agreement following the Israeli disengagement from Gaza in 2005 gives observers from the European Union de facto control over the Rafah crossing, but the European observers said that they will not return without security guarantees. Hamas wants Palestinians and Egyptians to have exclusive control over the terminal. Abbas has been demanding Hamas relinquish control of Gaza before commencing any discussion on the matter, but Hamas refuses to comply. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Rami Almighari in Gaza.
In Chile, jailed Mapuche activist Patricia Troncoso has agreed to end her hunger strike, now in its 113th day. FSRN's Jorge Garretón explains.
The Chilean government agreed to meet the two demands Patricia Troncoso made during her long hunger strike. The government will transfer Troncoso to spend the remaining sentence in an agrarian minimum security prison and grant Troncoso weekend passes along with two other jailed Mapuche activists. The government and Troncoso reached the agreement on Monday thanks to mediation efforts from the Catholic Church. Troncoso ended her strike today after assurances were given in writing. Troncoso and two other Mapuche activists were jailed for setting fires to forestry plantations in a controversial trial. Prosecutors charged the group under Chile's Pinochet-era anti-terrorist law and used secret witnesses to get a conviction. Mapuches say the land in question belongs to them. An attempted takeover of farmland in the Mapuche region led to a deadly clash earlier this month. The same day the government reached the agreement with Troncoso, it named a High Commissioner for Indigenous Affairs to negotiate with Mapuches on their land claims and work with Congress to approve a constitutional reform that seeks to recognize indigenous peoples in the Chilean constitution. For FSRN, this is Jorge Garreton in Santiago.
And those are the headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
To the dismay of some lawmakers and human rights advocates, Attorney General Michael Mukasey will not define waterboarding as torture. Members of the Senate Judiciary Committee challenged Mukasey to clarify his position at a hearing earlier today. Tanya Snyder has more.
Attorney General Michael Mukasey faced an outraged Senate Judiciary Committee today, forced to return volleys like this question from Senator Edward Kennedy.
So I won't even bother to ask you whether waterboarding counts as torture under our laws, because I know from your letter that we won't get a straight answer. So let me ask you this. Would waterboarding be torture if it was done to you?
Questions over the legality of waterboarding, a simulated drowning technique used in interrogations of prisoners, were a centerpiece of Mukasey's confirmation hearings last fall. He was seen by many as the man who would rescue the Justice Department from charges of unethical practices under Alberto Gonzalez. At that time, Mukasey refused to classify waterboarding as a technique of torture. Today was the first time since his confirmation that the Senate Judiciary Committee had the chance to revisit the issue, but it quickly became clear nothing had changed. When asked under what circumstances it would be lawful to waterboard a prisoner, Mukasey dodged the question.
For me to answer that question would be for me to do precisely what I said I shouldn't do, because I would be, number one, imagining facts and circumstances that are not present, and thereby telling our enemies exactly what they can expect in those eventualities. Those eventualities may never occur. I would also be telling people in the field, when I'm not faced with a particular situation, what they have to refrain from or not refrain from in a situation that is not performing, and in situations that they may find analogous.
Committee Chair Patrick Leahy was more definitive in his opposition to the practice of waterboarding.
Even our top law enforcement officer are now instructed by the White House not to say that waterboarding is torture and illegal. Never mind that waterboarding has been recognized as torture for the last 500 years. Never mind that President Teddy Roosevelt properly prosecuted American soldiers for this more than 100 years ago. Never mind that we prosecuted Japanese soldiers for waterboarding Americans during World War II. Never mind that this is the practice of repressive regimes around the world. That is not America.
Harold Nelson, advocacy director of TASC, the Torture Abolition and Survivor Support Coalition International, says the Senate got what they voted for.
That any member of Congress or the Senate is surprised at this surprises me. They voted for him when he would not say that waterboarding is torture. Why should they expect he'll do anything different now?
The Military Commissions Act of 2006 outlawed cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment of terror suspects, but did not clearly define what acts constituted such treatment. Congress looked to the Attorney General to rule on the specifics, which he has declined to do. The CIA claims it hasn't used waterboarding since 2003, and that the agency banned the practice in 2006. Mukasey said that he has reviewed memos about current CIA interrogation practices and finds them to be lawful. He said that since waterboarding is no longer used as an interrogation technique, he did not have to take a position on it.
Waterboarding is not among the techniques currently authorized for use in the CIA program. In that respect, passing on its legality is beyond the scope of the commitment that I made to this committee.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Tanya Snyder in Washington.
Italy is now beginning the process of creating an interim government after center-left Prime Minister Romano Prodi resigned from his post last week, a consequence of his coalition losing a majority in parliament. Diletta Varlesi files this story.
After the left-leaning government of former Prime Minister Romano Prodi collapsed last week, it was up to Italian President Giorgio Napolitano to decide the future of the country for the coming months. Today, Napolitano announced a new temporary government to finish up electoral law reforms instead of calling for early elections. Napolitano named the Senate President Franco Marini to lead the government.
Ho pertanto chiesto al Presidente del Senato, facendo appello al suo senso di responsabilità istituzionale.
I've asked the Senate President, trusting in his institutional capacity, to confirm with parliamentary coalitions that it is okay to move forward on electoral reform and eventually find consensus on other urgent decisions.
Funzionale all'approvazione di quel progetto e all'assunzione delle decisioni più urgenti in alcuni campi.
Electoral law reform was ongoing during Prodi's administration, but left and right coalitions encountered serious difficulties in approving a final text. In 2005, Italy transitioned from an additional member voting system to one of proportional representation. In the proportional system, the general population votes for a party, not for a specific candidate. The winning party chooses their leaders and their parliamentary representatives. The number of seats allotted to each party is determined by its share of votes. President Napolitano's decision was supported by all left-wing coalition members. Marzio Breda is a journalist who covers issues of parliament.
Marini is known as a good negotiator, able to communicate with both political sides. He'll first explore the possibilities to create a new government with the two coalitions.
If at the end of consultations with both wings of parliament, Marini assessed that there is no possibility to proceed with reform, the only alternative left will be to suspend the parliament and hold elections. The right-wing coalition is calling for immediate elections under current electoral law. Former Prime Minister and leader of right-wing coalition Silvio Berlusconi could refuse to cooperate with Marini's mandate. Italian voters are divided on the current political situation. Some say they think politicians are taking too many decisions without popular consultation. Bruno Cecchi is an Italian olive oil producer.
I truly believe that we should go to the election because laws are supposed to be studied according to the will of the majority of the people.
At 2 days' pronouncement, Franco Marini accepted the charge and declared,
"So bene."
I know this charge is heavy duty, but I also know that Italians are hoping for changes to the electoral system. I'll try to make it happen as quickly as possible and not make them wait too long because I understand that we don't have much time.
Marini will be at work tomorrow morning for his first parliamentary consultation before naming the temporary government. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Diletta Varlese in Brescia, Italy.
John Edwards has dropped out of the presidential race. Pledging to stay through Super Tuesday, Edwards' sudden departure came as a surprise to many. As FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports, he ended his campaign just how he started it, talking about poverty, with still hurricane-ravaged portions of New Orleans as his backdrop.
13 months after it began, it ended for John Edwards.
I am suspending my campaign for the Democratic nomination for the presidency. But I want to say this to everyone, with Elizabeth, with my family, with my friends, with all of you and all of your support, this son of a mill worker is going to be just fine. Our job now is to make certain that America will be fine.
In New Orleans, a town that has undergone a slow rebuilding process after Hurricane Katrina, especially in low-income areas, John Edwards focused much of his 2008 bid for presidency on the inequity between the rich and the poor, the inequity between the corporate boss and the worker, the inequity between the influence of the lobbyist and the average voter. He spoke on behalf of those again.
This work goes on. It goes on right here in Musicians Village. There are homes to build here and in neighborhoods all along the Gulf. The work goes on for the students in crumbling schools, just yearning for a chance to get ahead. It goes on for daycare workers, for steel workers, risking their lives in cities all across this country. And the work goes on for 200,000 men and women who wore the uniform of the United States of America, proud veterans who go to sleep every night under bridges, or in shelters, or on grates, just as the people we just saw on the way here today. Their cause is our cause. Their struggle is our struggle. Their dreams are our dreams. Do not turn away from these great struggles before us.
His campaign was unable to capitalize on a significant second place victory in Iowa. Perhaps it was because of his populist message. Or because that populist message contradicted his stances as a candidate in the 2004 presidential election and as U.S. Senator in North Carolina, where he sang a more moderate Democratic tone on war, the economy, and the environment. Or maybe it was because he could not break through the media and public obsession of the well-financed, demographically groundbreaking candidacies of Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. A third-place finish in his home state of South Carolina last Saturday killed all prospects of gaining the nomination. Edwards supporter Peggy Hupert is the former director of Iowans for Sensible Priorities, a group that endorsed Edwards because of his commitment to decrease defense spending and increase progressive domestic spending. She thinks Edwards' focus on poverty influenced the other candidates.
He was consistently voicing a message that was very important to be heard, and I think it has been heard by the American people.
I think he had a very positive effect. He really raised economic class issues in a pointed way that Hillary Clinton and even Obama just refused to do. And so we owe a lot to Edwards.
Norman Solomon, author and syndicated columnist on media and politics, says Edwards' exit will impact the outcome.
Because I believe now that Edwards is dropping out, most of his supporters and probably he will get behind Obama. I think that ultimately this is bad news for Hillary Clinton.
As Clinton is seen as the corporate establishment candidate. Edwards himself did not throw his support behind anyone else. But the field is finally down to two, and for the first time, no white male is vying for the nomination, which at this point is too hard to tell if that could or could not impact the outcome. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
The 2008 presidential campaign advanced last night, with John McCain and Hillary Clinton winning in Florida. For the GOP, it could mean that they now have a solid frontrunner for the first time this year. But for Democrats, the meaning is a little less clear. Mitch Perry reports from St. Petersburg, Florida.
In the days before the Florida Republican primary, pollsters said the battle between John McCain and Mitt Romney was too close to call. Some analysts thought Romney might have the edge, with voters saying the economy was the most important issue as they went to the polls. But McCain insisted that national security was the most important issue.
We Republicans have always known that the first responsibility of government is to keep this country safe from all enemies, foreign and domestic.
In his concession speech, Romney gave no indication that he was giving up. Although he said he called to congratulate McCain for his hard-fought victory, Romney said that change was still needed, and it wouldn't come from anybody based in Washington.
We asked them to fix Social Security. They haven't. We asked them to stop spending money on pork barrel projects. We asked them to balance our budget. They haven't. We asked them time and time and time again, and they just haven't gotten the job done. You see, Washington is fundamentally broken. And we're not going to change Washington by sending the same people back just to sit in different chairs.
The Florida primary also became the gravestone for Rudy Giuliani's campaign. He finished third in the contest, barely above Mike Huckabee. That's despite campaigning in the state for nearly 60 days. All part of his unique strategy that focused more on collecting convention delegates than winning early primaries. Giuliani led most national polls in Florida throughout all of 2007, but those polls proved to be illusory by early January. Giuliani was expected today to quit the race and endorse John McCain. At a campaign appearance in the Tampa Bay area on Monday, voter Tom Lincoln said he was undecided, but said he would never vote for Giuliani.
The reason I really came was just kind of to celebrate the idea that Rudy's probably going to lose tomorrow. And I think it would be good for the country if Rudy does lose because he hasn't been honest and straightforward with the events of September 11th.
Unlike the GOP affair, the Democratic primary, at least in the short term, has no effect on the Hillary Clinton-Barack Obama drama. That's because in a controversial move by the Democratic National Committee last summer, Florida was stripped of its delegates because its Republican-led legislature voted to move the primary into January against the DNC rules. Despite that, a record 1.7 million Democrats came out to vote in the primary. Hillary Clinton received 50% of the vote, Obama 33%, and John Edwards 14%. Clinton gave a speech last night in South Florida thanking Florida voters, but Obama surrogates implored the media not to give the race any attention, calling it meaningless. Massachusetts Senator John Kerry.
The bottom line is that Florida does not offer any delegates. It is not a legitimate race. It should not become a spin race. It should not become a fabricated race.
Florida Democrats went to the polls despite the claim that their vote would not count. Many were angry, and some said they weren't even sure if they should vote.
Oh, I don't understand. Why wouldn't Florida matter? We're a big state. That's just amazing to me to learn that.
Florida Democrats filed two lawsuits against the DNC's move not to recognize delegates. Both were thrown out. But one of the litigants, South Florida Congressman Alcee Hastings, wrote to DNC Chairman Howard Dean on Tuesday, warning that if the delegates are not reinstated, some Florida Democrats may not only stay home in November, but, quote, may change their party affiliations and some could actively campaign against us. Mitch Perry, Free Speech Radio News, St. Petersburg, Florida.
The military government of Burma has positioned 83 additional battalions in the eastern state of Karen for its yearly dry season offensive against rebel ethnic groups. The Karen Human Rights Group reports that one immediate effect of increased military presence is stepped-up demands for forced labor from villagers. This means clearing roads, repairing military buildings, transporting goods, and serving as security watches. From rebel-controlled Burma, Zach Badoff reports.
Burma Campaign UK estimates millions of Burmese have been used as slave laborers. The military junta requires people of all ages and genders to go to work for periods ranging from a single day to weeks at a time. Without adequate food, villagers frequently get sick along the way. If they can't continue, they're either left to die in the jungle or executed. Burma Campaign UK director Mark Farminer.
The farmers will just be taken from their fields and told to carry food or supplies by the soldiers. They would be made to walk in front of the soldiers because the regime doesn't keep records of where it places landmines. So they will use the slave laborers as human minesweepers. They walk in front, and if there are mines there, they will tread on them, and that will protect the soldiers.
Farminer says the regime's campaign of terror increases during the dry season. He says their claims to have banned forced labor are absolute nonsense. Nola Poipo escaped her life of de facto slavery by fleeing to a Thai refugee camp last year with her family of seven. Like most able-bodied people in her village, she was required to work for the Burmese military as a manual laborer from the age of 14. The junta forced her to work as a porter 3 to 4 times a month for 16 years.
We are treated like slaves. We have to go and do any work the military wants. We have to clean the house, feed the animals, construct the fences. We have to do everything they want.
Nola Poipo said she and the other villagers also had to stand night watches. They didn't have weapons, but if they saw strangers or rebel soldiers coming, they had to warn the Burmese troops. She said the Burmese military treated them inhumanely.
It seems like the Burmese soldiers all hate the Karen people. They want to get rid of all of us and restrict us in our daily lives.
The Secretary General of the Karen National Union, Man Shah, says the struggle of the Karen people since 1949 is a struggle for peace for the whole of Burma.
They want to enslave our people. So not only our people, inside Burma also, all peoples are become the slave. Even military regime, soldiers have become the slave. Because in the front line, they don't have enough food, they don't have enough supply. So they use the army like the slave.
With 90% of the Burmese population living on less than $2 a day, Mark Farminer says the situation in Karen State is one of the worst humanitarian and human rights crises in the world.
People have their ears, their nose, breasts, genitals, arms, hands could be hacked off. People have been tied to trees and tortured. People are executed. People have seen their babies thrown onto fires when the village is being destroyed. The abuses that are going on are beyond belief. I mean, it is as horrific as it gets of anything you would hear in the world. And it's been going on year after year after year after year.
At a Sunday church service for Karen people living in exile in Thailand, 50-year-old Thuy Po sings a Christian song. He comes here every few weeks from his home in the Thai-Burma border. He says when the Burmese military arrives in Karen areas, they shoot and kill without asking questions. He honestly can't remember how many times he's fled his village, but says the military junta attacks at least twice a year.
Before I born in my mother's womb, my mother ran, and also I ran in my mother's womb. So this is a Karen life.
But Karen refugee Nola Poipo still has hope.
We are born with a hope and desire of having our own freedom and land. I hope that in the future, things will improve in the Karen state so I can go back and live in my homeland.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Zach Baudorf in Burma.
Earlier this month, the Bush administration and many American lawmakers hailed a revised law on de-Ba'athification as a positive step toward reconciliation between Iraq's warring factions. The new law, euphemistically renamed the Accountability and Justice Law, is intended to reverse some of the damage done by former U.S. proconsul Paul Bremer's de-Ba'athification Law, a wholesale dissolution of the Iraqi government in 2003. But as Hiba Daoud reports, Iraqis think reconciliation between those who supported Saddam Hussein's government and those who support the U.S.-backed government is less likely now than ever.
Maha Abdel Latif is a professor of political science. She says many people were forced to join the Ba'ath Party simply to have jobs and support their families, rather than being driven by a particular ideology.
It is the people of Iraq who should decide how to reconcile the nation through free elections. There were 1.5 million Ba'athists. They are not all criminals.
Fattah Sheikh, a member of parliament, agrees, adding that much of the damage is undoable.
Many people were dismissed, including university professors, intellectuals, and other figures that could have helped rebuild the new Iraq. The Ba'athists who deserve to be dismissed from the political process are still involved today. We got rid of one dictator and oppressing party, but now the parties that represent the government are worse than the Ba'ath Party.
Abdel Latif, who openly supports violence against the U.S. troops and their proxies, is also sharply critical of the present administration.
The Accountability and Justice Law should be applied first to the present parties that slay people in the streets. A man was killed in front of me today on my way home. Would the Accountability and Justice people go after who killed him? Now it is worse than the Ba'ath Party.
Saleh Mutlaq, an Iraqi member of parliament who spends much of his time outside the country because of assassination attempts, says the law will make real reconciliation harder.
It means there is accountability against only one party, which is the Ba'ath Party, whereas the ones who killed and hijacked and stole the money of the people through the last 5 years are not questioned.
Mutlaq's critics, including many inside the government, have accused him of harboring Ba'athist sympathies. The commission headed by Falah Hassan Shenshel, a member of parliament allied with the cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, whose father was killed by Saddam Hussein's security forces. Since its inception, the committee has been headed by a member of a party that fought Saddam's government, casting doubt amongst many Iraqis on its impartiality. And as the government continues to be dominated by parties that were hostile to Saddam, Iraqis feel implementation of the law will be done unfairly. The process has been further complicated by the U.S. military's new policy of establishing militias in Sunni areas to encounter the extremists on all sides. Some of those employed by the U.S. to provide security have been accused of crimes while part of Saddam's government, as well as in atrocities, including ethnic cleansing and the mass executions and the violence that has occurred since the U.S. invasion. For FSRN, this is Hiba Daoud.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. From KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Tandisizwe Shimarenga.